We turn once again to Judges chapter 20. Here in Stornoway Reformed Presbyterian Church of Scotland for some months now, we have been studying together the Old Testament book of Judges. We come this morning to chapter 20. And as we read this narrative, three questions, or at least three questions, immediately demand our attention. The first is this: if the men of Gibeah were truly guilty of the crimes that were committed in chapter 19, why is it that the people of Benjamin refused to give up these men to the execution of justice? The second question is, if the children of Israel went out to battle against Benjamin with the authority of God, why was it that they were twice defeated by the Benjamites? The third question is, if Judges chapter 20 is about justice, why is there so much violence and bloodshed at the end of this chapter? We begin then at the beginning. You will remember the context is that in chapter 19, gruesome acts have been committed by the men of Gibeah. What began as sexual perversion ended up with murder. Now, at the beginning of Judges chapter 20, there is a petition from the Levite whose concubine was sexually assaulted and killed for justice, justice according to the law of Moses. And the children of Israel are ready to execute this justice. In verse 7, the petitioner says to them, "Look, all of you are children of Israel. Give your advice and counsel here and now." The men of Israel respond in verse 9 and they say, "None of us will go to his tent, nor will any of us turn back to his house. But now this is the thing which we will do to Gibeah." And so we are told in verse 11 that the men of Israel were gathered against the city of Gibeah, united as one man. And they make inquiries in verse 12, asking, "What is this wickedness that has occurred among you?" And they demand the lives of these wrongdoers in verse 13 when they say, "Now therefore deliver up the men, the perverted men who are in Gibeah, that we may put them to death and remove the evil from Israel." This is justice. This is justice according to the law that God had given to Israel through Moses. But the response of the children of Benjamin is at the end of verse 13. We are told that the children of Benjamin would not listen to the voice of their brethren, the children of Israel. Instead, verse 14 says, "The children of Benjamin gathered together from their cities to Gibeah to go to battle against the children of Israel." If the men of Gibeah were wrongdoers, why did the people of Benjamin refuse to give them up for the execution of justice according to God's law. The reason actually is quite simple. It is that the men of Gibeah belonged to the tribe of Benjamin. That is to say that the wrongdoers were part of the family of Benjamin. They were relatives. They belonged to the same clan. They belonged to the same tribe. And so the same blood was flowing through their veins. And they were kith and kin. And they refused to give up their own family, even if they were wrongdoers in the sight of God. When the men of Israel came up seeking justice, the men of Benjamin closed ranks. They decided to protect themselves. They decided to protect those who were their own. And they began to see the wrongdoers as insiders and those seeking justice as outsiders. As one commentator puts it, blood was thicker than God and His covenant. This was idolatry. You see, one of the primal idols of the natural human heart is the idol of family and relationships. I'm not saying that family and relationships are evil. How can it be? For families are instituted by God. And the fruit of the womb is the reward of the Most High God. But you see, idols are sometimes bad things that we worship. But more often, idols are actually the good things that God has given us that we turn into the ultimate things, the things that we depend on for our identity, for our security, for our joy, for our significance, and for our everything. The men of Benjamin made their blood, their relationships, and their family the ultimate thing, the most important thing, the treasure of their lives. And so God was displaced, and the idol of family took the place that rightly belongs to God alone. That's why they refuse to give up the men, the wrongdoers of Gibeah. And what was true of the men of Benjamin is still true in our world today, is it not? Why are there wars raging in so many places of this world? Why? Because we think that some people are insiders and other people are outsiders, and the insiders are fighting the outsiders. This was the idol of family, of tribe, of clan, and of relationships. And what is true of us as human beings is often true in the professing Christian church too, is it not? For all too often, even as Christians, we find our primary identity not in Jesus Christ, not in the God who loved us and gave Himself to us. Instead, we try to find it in our denominations and in the names and the histories of our congregations. That I say to you in the name of God is nothing other than idolatry. These are good things, but when we turn them into the ultimate things, we are guilty of idolatry. You remember the famous words of Professor John Rabbi Duncan of Edinburgh, who said, "I am first a Christian, then a Catholic, third a Calvinist, fourth a Pedobaptist, and finally a Presbyterian. I cannot," he said, "reverse that order. Our identity, our significance, and our ultimate security does not come from the denominations or the congregations that we belong to, however illustrious the history may be. But we are what we are because of who we are in Jesus Christ." The second question has to do with Israel's defeat before the Benjamites. We see this in verses 14 onwards, where we are told that the children of Benjamin gathered together from their cities in Gibeah to go to battle against the children of Israel. And the children of Israel go to the house of God in verse 18, and they seek counsel of God, and they say to him, "Which of us shall go up first to battle against the children of Benjamin?" They go up to battle the first time, and we are told that they are defeated in verses 20 and 21. The second time the children of Israel come before God again in verse 23, and they say to him, "Shall I again draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin?" And God gives an answer, and he says, "Go up against him." In obedience, the children of Israel go up in battle against the men of Benjamin, and again they are defeated in verses 25 and 26. The third time the children of Israel come before God, and they weep and they fast and they offer burnt offerings and peace offerings, and they begin to inquire of God. And this time in verse 28, God says to them, "Go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand." And the third time they win the battle. But why is it that they lost the first two times? I think there are at least four reasons for their defeat. The first is psychological. You see, the children of Benjamin were much smaller in their army than the men of Israel. So they were fighting, literally fighting for their lives. The men of Israel were perhaps complacent because of their physical or numerical superiority. The second reason might have been practical. The land of Benjamin was hilly, and the Benjamites lived upon the hills, and this gave them advantage over the approaching army from the plains. The third reason may be technical. In verse 16 of chapter 20, we are told, "Among all the people there were 700 select men who were left-handed. Everyone could sling a stone at a hair's breadth and not miss." The left-handed warrior had advantages over the right-handed one. But I think the supreme reason is not just psychological or practical or technical. It is theological. And I think this is the emphasis of the inspired writer himself. You notice how the children of Israel come before God. In verse 18, they say to him, Which of us shall go up first to battle against the children of Benjamin? Did you notice the question? They are not asking God, should we go up to battle? They are not asking God, will you go up with us into battle? They assume the presence of God and they assume the victory and they simply come into God's presence and they say, we are going up. Who do you think should go first from amongst us? And even the second time when they come before God, in verse 23 they say, they are humbler. They say, shall I again draw near for battle against the children of my brother Benjamin? Now they are asking, should we go? But notice, they are not asking, will you go with us? God does not give them in the first and in the second instance the promise of his presence with them. He never gives them the promise of victory. It is only the third time when they humble themselves before God that God gives them the promise and he says in verse 28, go up, for tomorrow I will deliver them into your hand. And then we are told that in verse 35, it was Jehovah who defeated Benjamin before Israel. How different the approach of the Israelites here from that of Moses. You remember when God appoints Moses to lead the children of Israel into the promised land. Moses prays before God and he pleads and he says, unless your presence goes before us, do not take us from here. For how will this world and how will the nations know that you are God unless you go with us? You know what the difference was? Moses was praying for God's glory, and for God's presence. These people were assuming the presence of God and simply asking for his blessing. They were guilty of the sin of presumptuousness. That's why they failed the first time, and they had to fail the second time also. And as I look around at the contemporary church, I wonder if this is not the reason for our weakness and our repeated failures. We have our plans, we have our logic, we have our strategies, we rely on the potency of our intellects and our experts. But each time we fail and we become the laughingstock of the people around us. Might it be that we are guilty of presuming the presence of God in our midst? Might it be true that what we are really after is not God and his glory, but our own glory and our own legacy? That's the difference between religion and the gospel. The gospel is about God and his glory only. Religion means that we make our plans and then we simply ask God to bless and to baptize our plans. That's what the children of Israel did. They had no promise. of the divine presence. They had no promise of victory. They simply assumed that because they were Israel, they were entitled to the divine presence despite their sins. The third question is, if this is all about justice and God's justice, why is there so much bloodshed? Well, the chapter begins with a desire for justice. But by the end of the chapter, what we see is not justice, but genocide. At verse 48, we are told, "And the men of Israel turned back against the children of Benjamin and struck them down with the edge of the sword from every city, men and beasts, all who were found. They also set fire to all the cities they came to." You see, when God gave his law through Moses, the law was clear that justice was to be proportionate. An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Never more, never less. But notice what the children of Israel do. Instead of just killing the men, the wrongdoers of Gibeah, they almost destroy the male population of the entire tribe of Benjamin. And if that was not enough, we are told that they killed, in verse 48, the children and the women also. They put to death all the beasts of the land, and they completely razed the cities to the ground. This is injustice. This is genocide. You see, justice flows from the fountain of God and His holiness. But genocide has a different source altogether. It flows from the desire for revenge, from bitterness. The writer to the Hebrews in chapter 12 at verse 15 speaks of the root of bitterness. And he quotes there from Moses in Deuteronomy chapter 29, where he speaks of the bitterness of wormwood and of gall. And you know, this man was a Levite. That meant that this man was a member of the church. He was not just another member. He was actually an officer of the ancient Jewish church. And his heart was filled with bitterness. That bitterness was thirsty for revenge. And this is what turned the quest for justice into genocide. What does it mean to be bitter? Well, it means to be hurt by somebody and to nurse that hurt and that wound so that there is resentment, there is disappointment, perhaps even there is hatred. The wound begins to fester and grow within us. And slowly but surely, perhaps unconsciously, it begins to harden us and it begins to dehumanize us. And this is why the first part of chapter 20 is important. For the petitioner is a Levite, and he pleads for justice. But look at the way he retells the story of chapter 19. He manipulates the truth. For we are told in verse 5 that the men of Gibeah rose against me and surrounded the house at night. Because of me, they intended to kill me. That's not true. Strictly speaking, that's not true at all. They did not intend to kill him. They intended to sexually assault him. But notice also in verse 5, he says, but instead they ravished my concubine so that she died. He does not tell them that it was he who willingly sent his concubine outside the house to be assaulted by the perverse men of Gibeah. You see what bitterness does to you and me? It always presents ourselves better than we actually are. And it always makes us to look other people to be worse than they actually are. The bitterness in your heart and in mine means that we always like to look impressive. We always present ourselves to be better than we actually are. And we are determined to make other people to demonize them and to make them look to be far worse than they actually are. That's the root of bitterness. And it was in the heart of this man who was an officer in the ancient church. He traced his heritage right back to Moses' brother Aaron, the first high priest of Israel. Now, my friends, you and I may be in the church today. But do you and I know something of this root of bitterness? You see, idolatry never stays as idolatry. Idolatry here leads to presumptuousness. Presumptuousness has led to bitterness and to vengefulness. What then is the solution? Well, bitterness will eat us up, and bitterness will cause us to devour those around us also. But we don't have to live in bitterness. There is an alternative, and that alternative is in Jesus Christ. For the opposite of bitterness is forgiveness. And forgiveness is what God offers to us in Jesus Christ. Forgiveness means that when somebody hurts me or harms me, I do not wait for them to have to pay the price. Instead, I am willing to pay the price for them. It means, forgiveness means, that I make a promise to myself and to the wrongdoer that I will not hold his wrongdoing against him, that I will not continue to remind him of his own wrongdoing, and that I will pay the price for his wrong. Not expecting him to pay it, but I pay it in his place. Forgiveness is the only solution to the problem of human bitterness. But where shall we find this forgiveness? Where shall we find the power to forgive each other? We will only be able to forgive each other if we have first experienced the forgiveness of God in Jesus Christ. It is only the immensity of our wrongdoing and God's forgiveness of our sins that gives to us the strength to forgive those who have sinned against us. And that power is found in the cross of Jesus Christ. You see, bitterness means that we are always seeking to present ourselves to be better than we actually are. But when Jesus Christ came to this earth, he was and he remains the sinless Son of the living God. And on the day when he was baptized by John the Baptist on the River Jordan, the heavens opened and there was the voice of the Father in heaven, and he said, "This is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased." There was no sin in Jesus Christ. He was the blameless one. There was no root of bitterness in him. 3 years later, when he was accused by the Jewish Sanhedrin of crimes against the Jewish nation and against Roman law, the Roman jurist who examined him, Pontius Pilate, declared, "This man has done nothing wrong." Still, he was condemned to die. And he was sentenced to death by crucifixion. And the prophet tells us that as a sheep which is led to the slaughter is silent, so Jesus Christ was silent before his sentence. And he went and he died on the cross. And you remember when he is thirsty, they offered him wine, bitter wine mixed with gall. He refuses to drink it. Why? You see, he did not die in bitterness. He died as the sin bearer of those who have been plagued by sin and the corruption and the bitterness of sin. It is only when you and I find our forgiveness in Jesus Christ that you and I begin to deal with the problem of bitterness, that you and I will begin to stop destroying ourselves and stop poisoning all our relationships. And perhaps you say, this is all good in theory, in terms of theology. But is this true? Well, let me close with two very quick illustrations. Some years ago, the then Archbishop of Canterbury led a team of Christian ministers for a series of peace talks with Hamas, the Palestinian militant organization. And as part of their dialogue, the Hamas leadership was asked if there was any possibility of peace with Israel, any possibility of reconciliation. One of the top leaders of Hamas replied, and he said, "I cannot see any chance of peace. My fathers and my brothers have shed their blood for Palestine. I am willing to die for my land, and the greatest thing that my little son can do for me is to give his blood for a free Palestine." To which one of the Christian ministers replied, and he said, "Sheikh Talal In your holy book and in mine, there is a story which tells us that not far from here in a mountain, God, thousands of years ago, asked Abraham to sacrifice his son. And just before he sacrificed his son, God provided a substitute. He provided a lamb for the sacrifice of Abraham. But 2,000 years ago, God provided a substitute for human sin. And God offered the sacrifice of his only begotten son. And Sheikh Talal, he said, unless and until you and I are prepared to accept the offering that God has provided for us and the forgiveness that he offers for us in Jesus Christ, you and I will never break the cycle of violence. And because we refuse to accept the sacrifice which God has provided, we will end up sacrificing our children and grandchildren after us. Sir, madam, I know my heart. I'm not asking you if there is a root of bitterness in your heart. I am simply telling you that this is a problem in my heart, and it is a problem in your heart too. You and I may pretend to be something we are not. You and I may impress the world, and we may cause them to think by our words and our actions that we are greater than we actually are. But you know what Jesus Christ calls you and me? He called the Pharisees hypocrites. You and I are no different. Until we experience the power of the death and the resurrection of Jesus Christ, we are men and women without hope. The Christian poet who had experienced the transforming power of the cross of Jesus Christ wrote these words: long my imprisoned spirit lay, fast bound in sin and nature's night. Thine eye diffused a quickening ray. I woke, the dungeon flamed with light. My chains fell off, my heart was free. I rose, went forth, and followed. Jesus Christ and Him crucified, the solution for time and the solution and hope for all eternity. May God bless His word to our hearts. We conclude by singing from Psalm 130. Psalm 130, and we are singing here the whole psalm. Lord, from the depths to Thee I cried, my voice, Lord, do Thou hear. Unto my supplication's voice, give an attentive ear. Lord, who shall stand, if Thou, O Lord, shouldst mark iniquity? But yet with Thee forgiveness is, that feared Thou mayest be. I wait for God, my soul doth wait, my hope is in His word. More than they that for morning watch, my soul waits for the Lord. I say, more than they that do watch the morning light to see, let Israel hope in the Lord, for with Him mercies be. And plenteous redemption is ever found with Him, and from all His iniquities He Israel shall redeem. Psalm 130, and we stand to sing to God's praise.
For from the depths to Thee I cry, my voice, Lord, do Thou hear.
And now may the God of peace, who brought up our Lord Jesus from the dead, that great shepherd of the sheep through the blood of the everlasting covenant, make you perfect in every good work to do his will, working in you that which is well-pleasing in his sight, through Jesus Christ, to whom be glory forever and ever. Amen.